What's Highly Controversial would run across 18 Iowa counties and cost nearly $4 billion. Answer, the Bakken Oil Pipeline. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. IPR's Amy Mayer tells us about the first public hearing about the controversial pipeline. Also, Joyce Russell tells us about this week's Heroin Crisis Summit. Chief investigative reporter for Politico, Ken Vogel, sheds new light on how the Koch brothers helped finance the campaign of Joni Ernst, a preview of Saturday's Democratic presidential debate in Des Moines, and do the undefeated Hawkeyes deserve their number 5 ranking? Buckle up for your news buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer on this Friday the 13th. Quick conversations to round off the week. Getting to some news that perhaps we heard a little bit about. We want to have some conversations about a little later in the hour. Joyce Russell will be along to tell us about this week's Heroin Crisis Summit. Also, I'll talk with the chief investigative reporter for Politico. Ken Vogel is his name. He'll shed some new light on how the Koch brothers helped finance the campaign of Joni Ernst during the primary. Very interesting stuff there. Also, do the undefeated Hawkeyes deserve their number 5 ranking in football? A few of the things yet to come. But first, yesterday, hundreds of Iowans gathered at the Boone County Fairgrounds for the first in a series of public hearings about the proposed Bakken Pipeline. This is the pipeline that would cost $3.8 billion, a run across part of the state, 343 miles diagonally across 18 Iowa counties, and it would carry crude oil from the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota to Illinois. And even though this pipeline has not been officially approved, the company has already hired contractors to lay the pipe. Iowa Public Radio's Amy Mayer attended the hearing. She joins me now. Hi, Amy.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon to you. So remind us, what exactly was this hearing for?
Yesterday was the opportunity for members of the public who had signed up in advance to speak for up to 2 minutes, either in favor of or in opposition to the proposed pipeline.
Mm-hmm. And so you got there, and it was a crowded affair.
It was. The room was packed. There were several hundred people who had come. 275 or 80 were signed up to speak. The rest were there to show support for the side they were on and to just take in all of the testimony that was presented.
Mm-hmm. And I think we want to hear some of the voices there that you collected. Who do we want to hear on both sides of the argument here?
Sure. Well, we had there were many, many laborers from different unions who were there for to support the pipeline. And here's one of them.
Like I said, my name is Nick Primick, and I'm a third-generation laborer from Waukee, Iowa. And I support the Dakota Access Pipeline for several reasons, first being the job creation that comes with a massive construction project like this one. Coming from a family that has survived for decades off wages earned from building Iowa, I know firsthand projects like this one don't come knocking on our doors very often. Projects like the Dakota Access Pipeline help folks not only get along, they help them get ahead. Now, some people will say these are temporary jobs, but I know every construction project breaks ground at some point, and at some point it has to come to an end. This is how the careers of a construction worker works.
Okay, that was a voice of Nick, is it Primick? He was one of the proponents of the pipeline. So an economically based argument there, Amy, is that primarily what the proponents had to offer to persuade?
Primarily economics in terms of jobs for those union members, and also they were citing the economic benefit that would come to the communities that the pipeline would pass through, at least during construction. The other major argument that the people who spoke in favor of the pipeline were making was that they claim pipelines are the safest way to move crude oil, and they cited a couple of recent train derailures in trains that were carrying fuel.
Mm-hmm. And this pipeline is not above ground, is it? It's underground, isn't it? A few feet?
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the people who are against it? We want to hear the voice of Carolyn Raffensperger of Ames. Let's listen to her. She was worried about the viability of the oil field.
The Bakken oil field is in free fall. it is no longer viable, and to consider a pipeline now for the Bakken oil field is a disaster. That is not going to be financially sustainable. Mm-hmm.
So Carolyn, talking about there, does that have to do with the recent fall in oil prices?
Oh, a fall in oil prices, and also I think she was citing actual amounts removed from the ground. You know, I think initially the rate of oil coming out of the ground in Bakken was a lot higher than it is now. Mm-hmm. I think that's what she was talking about. Mm-hmm.
So the people, the proponents, opponents of the Bakken pipeline were given up to 2 minutes, so it was rapid fire.
Absolutely. And there's three members of the Iowa Utilities Board, and they sat there and listened as one after another these citizens made their points. There was no real interaction between the board members and those who were testifying.
No follow-up questions, nothing like that.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
So this is the board, the Utilities Board, they're appointees of the governor.
Yes.
Does that give an indication of perhaps how they will decide?
Well, some of the people who oppose the pipeline certainly seem to think so. In some of those testimonies, there was a little bit of hostility toward board members, some accusations that they shouldn't be in the position they're in of making this decision, that they might simply be beholden to Governor Branstad because he appointed them. But obviously the members of the board did not express any opinions yesterday during those hearings.
I wonder if you can tell us anything about whether these board members have expertise in this area when it comes to pipeline safety or the economics of it and so forth.
Well, for example, one of the board members is Nick Wagner, and he is a former legislator and a former city councilor from Marion, but he's also a trained engineer. He's worked for a variety of energy companies, and he sits on or participates in several different utility groups regionally and nationally. Libby Jacobs is another board member. She's been on the board for the longest of the three, since 2011, and she also has been involved with a lot of different utility groups. She's previously worked in strategic planning and telecommunications and nonprofit management. So the third member who chaired the meeting yesterday and is the chair, or the hearings yesterday, is Jerry Huser, also a former legislator and a former city councilor. Her professional background is in law and social work. This is just the profile information I got from the Utilities Board website. So that's what mm-hmm. I have to offer.
And so what happens now? Do they decide, or are there other public hearings?
There are no more opportunities for individual members of the public to sign up and testify, but over the rest of this month and the first few days of December, the board will be hearing from Dakota Pipeline and from other third parties who will be producing their evidence on why Dakota should be issued the permit, or I suppose the opportunity would be for other there's third parties. I don't know who those third parties are, mm-hmm. but it's this opportunity for Dakota to make their case. And at the end of that, the board does have the option to have another public meeting to discuss their decision-making. They don't have to do that. They can. At some point, though, the three of them will make their decision.
Mm-hmm. And what they say goes.
That's my understanding.
Mm-hmm. So as I indicated at the outset here, through your reporting also, that it seems that this Dakota Access LLC, the unit of the Dallas-based Energy Transfer Partners, seems to be pretty confident that this is going to be approved, already hiring contractors to lay pipe, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think one might look at that situation and say it's a way for them to try to force the issue to make it inevitable. But I don't think that's actually the case. I mean, that may be their strategy, but I don't think that it's going to have that kind of impact.
Did you get the sense at this hearing and having covered it that it is a done deal?
Oh, no.
No.
No, I didn't get that sense.
Okay. Amy Mayer, thanks for following up on this story, the controversial Bakken pipeline, the first hearing, public hearing this week that Amy Mayer attended. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday at the University of Iowa College of Public Health in Iowa City, representatives of law enforcement, medicine, public health, and others gathered to talk about the growing problem of heroin addiction across the country and, yes, here in Iowa. Opioid and heroin deaths in the state have quadrupled since 2005. Iowa Public Radio's Joyce Russell was there. She joins me now. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, Ben.
So tell us a little bit more, some background here, about why this summit was needed, was held.
Well, as you just said, increasing numbers of opioid and heroin addiction and also deaths from overdose. The really interesting part of the summit yesterday was sort of going back to why there's been such an explosion of opioid abuse And it goes back to a change in American medicine back in the 1990s, where it just, there was a shift from, sort of thinking that pain is something patients should just accept, to thinking that pain should be aggressively treated, and an understanding at that time that opioids were not really, there's no danger of addiction. Well, that turned out to be very wrong. The pharmaceutical industry, of course, played a role in this shift. And so that's where it started. And over those years, there's been a growing problem with addiction to painkillers primarily. And then over time, that evolved into a heroin problem because they are almost identical, as we were told yesterday. A very, very similar molecule, very, very similar response in the addict. Also very, very similar response in trying to get out from under that addiction.
Right. So this prescription drug abuse is sort of the pathway to heroin. People can reach that state where they say, okay, enough with the prescription drugs that are based on this, you know, derivative of the poppy plant, and go for the heroin.
Well, the motivation there is that prescription drugs, if you're addicted to prescription drugs, they're expensive to get if you doctor shop and get them, or if you take them from family and friends. There's no real good source for that. A very interesting thing that came up yesterday is that that's a felony to share prescription drugs, but very few people know that. So that's one issue. And so the expense of them, and then the heroin has just become, sort of simultaneously to this trend, it's just become very available and much cheaper than prescription drugs. And there was also really interesting stuff yesterday about the Mexican cartels sort of being at the right place at the right time bringing the heroin product to the United States and selling it in comparing it to selling pizza, and worked out a really effective distribution model. Mm-hmm. And so all those things are happening at the same time, and the result is an increase in heroin addiction.
A real challenge for law enforcement, also for people there involved in treatment, also people really affected, families. This is devastating for families. I understand you talked, you heard from a parent of a young man, well, in his 30s is when he died, but he developed this addiction very early.
He did. We're talking about Kim Brown, and I knew Kim Brown because she was at the Capitol last year, and she says she'll be back this year lobbying for easier access to a drug that is an antidote to drug overdose. And so I had heard her story. She told it yesterday very effectively about her son, who, as you just implied, he had surgery as a young teenager. He came home with Percocet. And then we didn't hear all of the steps between taking Percocet at 14 and becoming addicted to heroin, but it was clear that there was a link there. And then his name was Andy Brown. He had two overdoses before he finally had the third one that killed him. And Kim Brown's case is that there was someone with him. He didn't just die alone. There was someone with him. And her case is, if that person or even a family member had had access to this antidote, it could have made a difference. Her point is that if you have a family member who is an addict, a heroin addict, you should have this antidote in your medicine cabinet. So if you're the person who's around when the overdose death is happening. Mm-hmm. And there was also talk yesterday about people should know what an overdose looks like. I mean, it's in order to know when to seek help. There was a nurse from a emergency room nurse there who only identified herself as Sarah, and she said that emergency rooms, of course, have seen many, many of these overdose cases.
Mm-hmm. Also, another takeaway from this summit, I think, is that we really have to watch out for those unused prescriptions that may be in our medicine cabinets. There are people after those. It might be someone visiting your home. It could be, a tradesman, somebody coming in to fix up something in your house may find himself in the cabinet and know that there's value to these things.
That could happen. They made the case yesterday that it's mostly from family members, and this might be young people stealing the stuff from their parents' medicine cabinet, or even someone gave the example of stealing something from your grandmother's medicine cabinet. Mm. But the underlying issue there is the overprescription of these drugs in the first place. And I had heard this argument before that they shouldn't give a prescription for 45 Percocets, And so that's the other public policy issue that was addressed yesterday and we'll continue to hear about. Okay. Is Iowa's prescription drug monitoring system, where providers, pharmacists, doctors, when they make a prescription, they put it on this registry so that another doctor or another pharmacy can see this person has already had a prescription. The problem is that the participation in that prescription drug monitoring program is voluntary. And, one of the officials I talked to yesterday says, as long as it's voluntary, we don't even, you'll hear so many states have these prescription drug monitoring programs. Well, they don't even count Iowa because it's voluntary.
Right. Joyce.
But it's been a struggle to get that expanded in the legislature.
Thank you for some of the facets of this heroin summit, community in crisis, heroin and opioids. As a matter of fact, I was also at the heroin summit yesterday. We'll hear more in depth about this summit next Thursday on this program, November 19th, devoting an entire hour to the heroin crisis. Joyce Russell, thank you for now.
Okay.
A News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. The undefeated University of Iowa Hawkeye football team ranked number 5 in the nation in the latest poll. That's the first time that's happened in 5 years. Mike Loss is with us, sports columnist with the Cedar Rapids Gazette. He joins me now to talk about the game this weekend, the playoffs. Also, the first ever, we'll hear about the grapple on the gridiron. Mike, welcome to the program, sports columnist for the Cedar Rapids Gazette.
Thank you. Good to be on.
So what does it mean, number 5? Iowa? Really? The 5th best team in the nation?
No, it doesn't mean that the fifth best team in the nation, but it means that they're ranked 5th in the college football playoff rankings.
Okay. Isn't that what rankings are all about?
There is a difference. It's a subjective thing, but what it means is that through 9 weeks of the season, they're perfect. Record-wise, they've got a body of work that's impressed the 12-person playoff committee.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, it doesn't mean anything more than they have to keep winning the rest of their games if they are to actually get into those playoffs.
Okay. What do the Hawkeyes need to make those playoffs? They have to make every one of the remaining games, 4 games, 3 games?
Right. They have 3 regular season games, and if they win those 3, they'll be 12-0. They'll go to the Big Ten championship game, which they may do even if they go 2-1. But for the playoffs to even be a remote possibility, they have to win all 3.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's say they win all 3, then they go to the Big Ten championship game where they would play either Ohio State, Michigan, or Michigan State, all of which are marquee teams. If they were to win that game, they'd be 13-0 and win the final playoff rankings committee meeting takes place, it would be extremely unlikely that Iowa would be excluded from the final 4 teams and would go to the playoffs. But that's, as anybody connected with the football team would tell you, is putting the cart about a mile ahead of the horse.
Yeah, right. We don't even want to say national championship or national champion at this point, do we?
They need to win tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night, they're facing the Minnesota Gophers. The Gophers not doing so hot this year, 4-5, 7 p.m. Kickoff at Kinnick Stadium in Iowa City. And what do you expect from this game?
Well, the 4-5 record, you're right, disappointing. If there's such a thing as a good 4-5 team, I think Minnesota is it. 2 weeks ago, they were a half yard from beating Michigan, which would have been a big upset and a great win. Last week they were at Ohio State, lost by two touchdowns, but played them very tough. They're a physical, competitive team. They clearly haven't packed it in for the season, despite disappointments, and it's a rivalry game. Mm-hmm. Iowa, on the other hand, as we've discussed what Iowa has to play for, and I think the atmosphere is going to be off the charts. A night game, a 9-0 record, the first sellout they've had in their last 10 home games, and I think it's going to be an atmosphere that borders on wild.
You quote in one of your articles, Big Ten Committee Chairman Jeff Long saying that what Iowa lacks in sizzle, they make up for in substance. Explain that.
Well, they're not the flashiest team. I mean, some of the teams, for instance, Baylor, Oklahoma State, they score points in by the bushel basket. Iowa is a traditional Big Ten successful team, built on defense, built on power, built on physicality. They're not going to blow anybody out. But their game is built on wearing you down over three quarters and then owning the fourth quarter. That may not be as enticing to casual fans, but at the end of the day, all they ask is not how you won, but did you win? And so far, they've been winning.
Something interesting happening at the game tomorrow. Grapple on the Gridiron is what it's being slated as. The first ever wrestling match to be held on the field at Kinnick Stadium. Is this a halftime thing?
No. It's at 11 a.m. The football game's at 7 p.m. It's a separate event. They've already sold 35,000 tickets. I wouldn't be surprised if the crowd is beyond 40,000, maybe pushing 45 even, and the weather's supposed to be nice. It is the first college wrestling dual meet to be held in an outdoor stadium. It is going to not just break the all-time record for attendance at a college wrestling meet. It's going to double it and more. And it's Iowa and Oklahoma State, which are traditionally the two most storied college wrestling programs in America.
Right. We've got about a minute left. I'm just trying to think what has made this possible. It's those huge high-definition screens, because otherwise 40,000 people watching two tiny ant creatures would not have very much fun.
No, and the first 20,000 seats or so were sold. To be reasonably close, they estimated that they'd be no further than had they been in Carver Hawk Arena. After that is general admission. You know what you're getting. But, yeah, they do have video screens, and I think just being there will be part of the experience for a lot of people.
Okay. Going back to the football game, is Iowa lucky? Did you see this coming for the Iowa football team this year, that they could be such contenders?
No one did. No one. I mean, 9-0 requires a lot of harmonic convergences, and they have had those.
Harmonic convergence. Are you translating luck into some more syllables, Mike?
No, I mean, luck is involved. I mean, you have to win the close games, and maybe you catch a team that has a running back who's out for the game with an injury, all sorts of things. But in the end, if you're 9-0, it means you're very good.
Okay, Mike Loss, sports columnist for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Thanks for catching us up, Mike. Talk to you again.
You bet.
When we come back after a short break on this News Buzz edition of River to River, we'll talk with the chief investigative reporter for Politico, Ken Vogel. He'll shed some new light on how the Koch brothers helped finance the campaign of Joni Ernst. He said an article that just was published online yesterday. And then a preview of Saturday's Democratic presidential debate in Des Moines. It's only the second one. Rachel Caulfield of Drake University will be with us to talk about that Democratic presidential debate. Don't go away. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, a preview of tomorrow's Democratic presidential debate. It's only the second one that we've had between Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and Martin O'Malley, to be held at Drake University in Des Moines. A preview of that with Rachel Caulfield in just a few moments. But first, an article this week, very interesting, by Politico, shedding new light on how the Koch brothers helped finance the campaign of Joni Ernst. It was back in 2013. Ernst was a little-known Iowa State senator, lieutenant colonel in the National Guard, considering a long-shot campaign for the GOP nomination for the U.S. Senate 2 years ago. Remember that election? She ended up easily defeating the Democratic nominee, Congressman Bruce Braley. Ken Vogel joins me now, chief investigative reporter for Politico, author of an article published yesterday online titled How the Kochs Launched Joni Ernst. It looks at how the Kochs networks of financial support for Ernst offers a first sign of a move into GOP primaries by the Koch brothers. Ken Vogel, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Ben.
So in your article, you say that at least a half dozen other Republicans, some even with better funding and connections, stronger establishment support, were positioning themselves to run against the presumptive Democratic nominee, Representative Bruce Braley. Enter the Koch brothers. What happened?
Well, the Koch brothers, after 2012, like a lot of big money Republican funders, concluded that their efforts in that 2012 election were hampered by flawed candidates who, for one reason or another, were unelectable. And so the Kochs, who for the most part had not only avoided politics as a whole, that is, they preferred to sort of stay on the policy side and do issue ads that maybe to lay viewers looked like political ads. Nonetheless, they thought of themselves as more policy wonks, so they didn't get involved in elections, and they certainly didn't get involved in primary elections. But they started to conclude that, hey, maybe they would have to do so, have to start dipping their toes into primary elections, Republican primary elections, in order to prevent Republican nominees, politicians from winning Republican nominations who were not going to be able to win the general election. And 2014 was the first time that they started to do this, albeit surreptitiously, in a way that we were unable to see at the time until now when some of these documents came out. Joni Ernst was really a beta test for them. They saw her as the most viable contender and one who, if not completely philosophically aligned with their brand of small government, free market, sort of libertarian-infused conservatism, at least was palatable to them and could beat Braley. And so they got involved, and we found documents that showed that they were involved in a big way early on.
Okay, so this is after a meeting that you recount that happened in Albuquerque. Joni Ernst invited down there. She evidently impressed key people very much. What kind of support followed? How much are we talking about?
So we're talking about several hundred thousand dollars of support in the primary election, and this came through a nonprofit registered under a section of the tax code, section 501c4, that allows groups to spend money in elections without disclosing the donors, without disclosing where they got that money. This is an avenue for political spending that was expanded by the Supreme Court Citizens United decision back in 2010, and the Kochs took advantage of it in this case by funneling money from the nonprofit that oversees their network, which is called Freedom Partners Chamber of Commerce, to a nonprofit that they had just set up, or rather that an operative who works in the Koch network had set up, called Trees of Liberty. It received this grant from Freedom Partners and went up on the air with ads attacking Mark Jacobs, a retired energy executive who was seen at the time as sort of Ernst's leading rival for the Republican nomination, attacking him for supporting cap and trade, which, interestingly, is a policy that the Koch political network and also Koch Industries, the Koch brothers' multinational industrial conglomerate, had opposed back in 2009 and 2010. So you see a little bit of a confluence here between the Koch brothers' increasing forays through their network into politics and also their business interest, that being oil refining, which would have been infringed by cap and trade bill.
So we see the Koch brothers active in getting Joni Ernst to the top of the heap in that primary, Republican primary. What about the general election? Do we know anything more about that?
Yes, and in the general election, actually, even during the primary, because, of course, while there was a competitive Republican primary, Bruce Braley was pretty much unopposed. In fact, I think he was totally unopposed
yes.
for the Democratic nomination. So even as this group, Trees of Liberty, was airing these ads that were swiping Jacobs and seeking to soften him up a little bit for the primary election with Ernst, another group, the group that wrote the check to Trees of Liberty, Freedom Partners Chamber of Commerce, which again is sort of lead group in the Koch network, was airing ads attacking Bruce Braley over his vote for Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, back in 2010. So we saw this sort of two-pronged attack. And then once the general election matchup was set between Ernst and Bruce Braley, we saw other Koch-backed groups, including Americans for Prosperity, go up with web ads and other efforts to knock down Bruce Braley, Joni Ernst. In both cases, both the primary and the general election, it should be pointed out, cruised 202 to victory. So, you know, while it can be argued to what degree the Koch money was pivotal in sort of helping her get to the U.S. Senate, it certainly didn't hurt.
What has Joni Ernst herself said about this funding that you've uncovered?
Well, it's interesting. You know, right after the right after we learned that she had attended that first Koch Brothers summit back in 2013 in Albuquerque, I was actually working on a book, and so I called her up. And at the time, she had just come out of this meeting, and these ads had not yet gone up on the air, but there was some thinking in the Koch network that she would be a beneficiary of some of their spending. And I called her up and said, hey, how'd you get this invite? And she said, you know, I don't really know how my name came through those channels, but I was happy to go and happy to have the chance to talk to these donors. Subsequently, after she ended up winning the primary, she went back to the next year's Koch Donor Summit, and she thanked the donors. She said, the first time that I was introduced to this group a year ago, August in New Mexico, I was not known at that time. The exposure to this group and to this network and the opportunity to meet so many of you, that really started my trajectory. She said this in a closed-door meeting, but it was actually recorded by someone who ended up giving it to a liberal blogger who posted it online, which, you know, was interesting when it went up online in the first place several months back, but it's especially interesting now that we know sort of what she was talking.
Another dimension of your article, very interesting, is you say this departure, this new tactic by the Koch brothers' financial network there really sets them up in a different relationship, perhaps, with the official Republican Party. How do they view each other when you look at this? Are they rivals or on the same team?
I think that there's a little bit of both. And certainly I think that both sides try to project harmony because they realize that ultimately they both want to elect Republicans. It's just that the Kochs want to elect a certain kind of Republican. It's not enough for them just to find the most electable candidate. If that candidate takes stances on their animating fiscal issues that they see as facilitating either big government spending or big regulation of industry or crony capitalism, this term that they like to throw out to talk about subsidies that they oppose, that they think skew the free market. So it does set up a potential rivalry there. And we have seen this rivalry play out in other ways, sort of more tactical ways, where the Kochs have invested a lot of money, for instance, in a data company that does voter data and data analytics and does advertising buying. Well, this is one of the things that the parties traditionally have controlled, particularly on the voter data side. The parties were the sole sort of purveyor on both sides, Democratic and Republican, of the master voter piles. Well, when you have groups that are outside of the party that are run by extremely wealthy private individuals who may have used it or aligned in some cases, in other cases differ from those of the party, it puts the party in a tough spot where they no longer control one of the key sort of bits of one of the key political tools that is used to run election.
When you looking forward here in the next two or three minutes that we have left, given what you've uncovered here about the Ernst campaign, the funding for it via the Koch brothers, what can you tell us about what's going on now and the questions you want to have answered about this political season?
Well, certainly whether they will continue to make these kinds of forays into primaries. As I said, this Ernst example was really a beta test, and we hadn't seen too much like that in the past. They have said some things that suggest that maybe they will go into these primaries in a more overt way, that is not through these more difficult-to-trace means. And then also, obviously, people are wondering about the presidential race because this is one where Charles Koch despite the fact that he and his brother have sort of played a little bit of a refereeing role in, to some extent in the primary by choosing which candidates get access to their donors and are invited to these seminars like those that Ernst attended, and also choosing who gets to access to this voter file that we talked about, the private company in the Koch network maintains. But they have said, Charles Koch said recently, that they will not actually pick a candidate in the primary, in the presidential primary. That does, however, still leave open the question of whether they'll get involved in more congressional primaries or down ballot primaries, like what we saw with Ernst in 2014.
Mm-hmm. And before we have to go in just a minute, let's broaden it out to talk about campaign finance reform. You're the author of a book called Big Money about how the ultra rich are playing a bigger and bigger part in American politics, not just in the Republican Party, but in the Democratic Party as well. I wonder, with campaign finance reform picking up steam, a greater concern among more and more Americans, do you think we'll reach a tipping point where there will be campaign finance reform? Will it get changed, even though those in office at present have that to thank for getting them elected?
Well, that's the key there, Ben, that last point. It's very difficult to generate the political will to change a system that the people who are being asked to cast the votes to change the system, that's just a work quite fine for them. They're in office. So typically, I think what prompts the political will, what generates enough political will to change to enact campaign finance reform, is a major scandal that would really seize the public's attention, generate the public will to pressure the politicians to pass law. I don't actually see anything like that on the horizon, and it's sort of a little bit of a catch-22 that's discouraging for folks who want there to be reform, which that's because it's become harder and harder to actually trace the money back to the donors, like we talked about with this group Trees of Liberty that supported Joni Ernst. Now we know where the money came from in terms of the nonprofit that wrote the grant to Trees of Liberty, but I don't think we'll ever find out who the donors were to the original group that gave the money that became the grant to Trees of Liberty. So it's harder to trace the money, and without the ability to trace the money to a quid pro quo, which is really difficult to prove in the first place between a donor and a politician, I think the chances for reform are pretty slim.
Fascinating work. Ken Vogel, thank you very much. Chief investigative reporter for Politico, author of an article published just yesterday online titled How the Kochs Launched Joni Ernst. Ken Vogel, I hope we have a chance to talk again in the future. Thank you for now.
Me too. It was a pleasure.
And finally today, this Saturday night, tomorrow night at 8 p.m., Drake University will host the second Democratic presidential debate taking place in Cheslow Auditorium in Des Moines. Rachel Caulfield is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Drake, also associate director of the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, one of our regular political analysts on Wednesday. Rachel Caulfield, it's Friday. I hope you can still do the analysis for us.
I can certainly try.
So, okay. Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Martin O'Malley, what issues do you expect that they'll have to face?
Well, I think, you know, Democratic voters on the whole, and Iowa Democratic voters in particular, are starting to see some issues come up to the surface. I think you have a lot of particularly young voters, and since we're on a college campus, that matters, particularly young voters that are interested in the environment, and they're interested in education, and particularly the costs of higher education. And I think that there's an increasing focus on jobs and making sure that, we have a healthy base of jobs going forward.
Mm-hmm. So can you give us the challenge you see for each of the three candidates, starting with Hillary Clinton?
Sure. I think Hillary Clinton needs to maintain momentum. Clearly, she's been doing really well in the polls, and her lead over Bernie Sanders seems to be getting bigger. The challenge is always to not peak too soon. And you want to be able to maintain that momentum. You know, we're still 3 months out, and in political land, that's a long time. So she needs to be able to maintain that momentum, demonstrate that she's likable, and that she's the front runner for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Bernie Sanders, I think he continues to need to kind of establish that he is not a fringe candidate. He has a strong base of support right now, but if that support is going to grow, he needs to make clear that this is a viable campaign for the presidency, and he's a little bit more mainstream than he was originally cast as in this race.
Do you expect him, Bernie Sanders, to be more on the attack here? We had the standout Bernie Sanders-Hillary Clinton interaction last time, of course, about the emails when he said, you know, no one cares about your damn emails. So it was a very helpful move for Clinton, I guess, in hindsight. Do we expect him to be more on the offensive, attacking her in a real way?
Yeah, and that was one of those beautiful debate moments where it may have helped Clinton, but it also helped Sanders. I think it's very true to who he is and how he thinks about that particular issue. And, you know, for a year when people are really highlighting the need for authenticity, it demonstrated a real sense of authenticity to his supporters. So whether or not he's going to go on the attack, I think he's certainly going to try to differentiate himself from Clinton, whether he does that through direct attack or whether he does that through, you know, more substantive differentiation. You know, that's something obviously that his campaign is working on right now.
How does Martin O'Malley punch through to become more competitive?
I think anyone who's seen Martin O'Malley on the campaign trail knows that he has a campaign style that fits in Iowa really nicely. And I think, you know, I've said this several times, I think, you know, the Clinton campaign, no one doesn't know Hillary Clinton. So there may be a ceiling to her support. I think there's probably a ceiling to Bernie Sanders' support. And I think Martin O'Malley is the guy who has room for movement more than either of the other two candidates who remain in the race. So, you know, I think what he wants to demonstrate is that he's a fresh voice for the party. He's true to progressive ideals, but, you know, he's not part of the establishment. He's also not part of the left wing of the party. He's trying to chart that middle course there.
And then now some would say that he's actually still in the race because he's running for vice president.
I've heard that said, and certainly if that's the case, it wouldn't be the first time that a candidate has done that. You know, I think prior to last summer, very few people in the country had probably ever heard of Martin O'Malley. And he's proven to be, I think, a likable candidate who's stronger on the issues than a lot of Democrats may have originally realized.
Let's talk a little bit about the structure of the debate there at Drake. Rachel Caulfield is my guest of Drake University, and you will be certainly at the debate. It will be hosted by CBS News, also moderator John Dickerson. How will the debate be structured? Do you know that at this point?
I don't know the rules of the debate at this point. I know that we have John Dickerson will be the primary moderator, but we also have local moderators from the Register and KCCI.
What's the scene like there now? The national media descending like locusts on on Cheslaw Auditorium.
Yes, every media organization that I think anybody has ever heard of is descending on Drake University's campus right now. It's a lot of fun to watch. But at 5 a.m. this morning, NBC was broadcasting from across the street from campus, and anybody who's had a chance to drive by or check out Twitter lately knows that we have a nice hashtag sculpture in the front yard of Old Main that's lit up at night. It's absolutely beautiful. So, you know, we're really looking forward to tomorrow night's debate, but the buzz itself is so much a part of why this is a great experience.
Now, I haven't had a chance to talk to you about the fourth GOP debate, which we had here. I'd love to have your takeaways from that. What did you see?
I think, well, first of all, it was a much better debate than the CNBC debate. That's a low bar, but
that was basically get out there and fight, guys.
Yeah, that was a get out there and fight. That's exactly right. And I, you know, I think this one was much more substantive. The candidates seem to really want to stay on the issues much more. Trump, I think, had a harder time establishing himself relative to the other candidates, and you've started to see the other candidates find effective response lines to Trump, which I find.
Did you have an example in mind?
Well, so I'm thinking, for example, of Fiorina's comment about, you know, she didn't just share green room with Putin; she actually met with him in a room.
Right.
You know, and you had Rand Paul point out that the TPP actually doesn't have anything to do with China. So I think that there are some, you know, they're starting to figure out how to respond with quick little comments rather than trying to take Trump on as a whole.
Less than a minute left. Where do you stand on this question? Reading about this from various political analysts, one can get a feeling that the GOP establishment is in a panic. There's no established front runner at this point. It's not clear whether an outsider or an establishment figure will come to the top.
Yeah, it's a very dynamic race, and I think they knew that it would be going into this process. They know that they have pretty significant factions within the party that are not aligning neatly with where the party has traditionally been. But, you know, 2012, that race was also incredibly fluid throughout the fall of 2011. You know, in November of 2011, Herman Cain and Newt Gingrich really had the spotlight.
Okay.
So, you know, I don't think it's to be unexpected at this stage in the race.
Okay, Rachel Caulfield, thank you very much, of Drake University, where she's associate professor in the Department of Political Science, also associate director of the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. Have fun tomorrow night. Hold on to your hat, Rachel.
I'm going to try.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.